Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Besieged is the word slapped on the White House this week. It's Iraq push under attack as the Senate now votes for targets for withdrawal. The president's attorney general, Alberto Gonzalez, all but called a liar by his own resigned chief of staff. And across the pond, old ally Tony Blair looking helpless as Iran grabs British Marines. The president joked at this week's correspondents' dinner about the woes he faced a year ago. Ah, he said, those were the good old days. Up next on Point Tornadoes, Pat Tillman and the siege in Washington with our weekly news roundtable. We've got a great crew with us today to take on the headlines. From Washington, Gene Cummings is with us, former White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal, now with The Politico, the new online Capitol Hill news magazine. Gene Cummings, thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome.
And from Washington, Gerard Baker, U.S. editor for The Times of London, former Washington bureau chief for The Financial Times. Gerard Baker, great to have you back with us.
Thank you very much.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Gene, and Gerard.
These headlines just keep coming back. I want to try to get to the crux and maybe paths of resolution for each. Let's start with Alberto Gonzalez, the Justice Department, and how that is reaching into the White House. Gene Cummings, you followed this area closely. Give us your summary. At the end of this week, where do we stand? Where have the events of this week pushed this big story?
Well, they have pushed this story further into the White House. For the first time, we heard from Kyle Sampson, the former chief of staff to Alberto Gonzalez, that Karl Rove had actually complained about some of these U.S. attorneys. And it seems clear to me that the Democrats will try to chase that line down to find out just what was the role of Karl Rove in this, in the firings of these attorneys. And the great irony here is the White House in mishandling this, all of this. The idea that the political office in the White House was involved in the hiring or selection of political appointees normally would not be a big deal. Mm-hmm. But the White House has so botched this and painted it all with political motives that are well beyond, you know, do you embrace our philosophy and have you been a loyal member of the party, to specifically what are you investigating, and you're investigating the things we don't like, which is the kind of interference that, you know, sets off all kinds of problems in this town.
Talk about micromanaging, the word the president uses for Congress on the war, maybe happening here in the Justice Department. And, of course, Kyle Sampson, the former chief of staff to Alberto Gonzalez, laying out what looks like a Gonzalez lie this week, to put a very sort of plain word on it. Here's Sampson testifying before the Senate hearing yesterday on the firing of eight U.S. attorneys. He's being questioned by Pennsylvania Republican and ranking member Arlen Specter.
I remember discussing with him this process of asking certain U.S. attorneys to resign, and I believe that he was present at the meeting on November 27th.
So he was involved in discussions, contrary to the statement he made in his news conference on March 13th.
I believe, yes, sir.
That is, Alberto Gonzalez not giving the whole truth in his public statements there, at least by Kyle Sampson's measure. Gerard Baker, where do you see the crux of this one going, and is there a resolution out there?
Well, I think the problem is what you are seeing here, and as Gene was talking about, a kind of unraveling, I think, in the to some extent more broadly in the White House and the Bush administration. I mean, the initial offense, if you can call it that, is what the White House is being accused of the administration is being accused of firing these attorneys. That seems to me to have been something that, you know, was an arguable issue. Presidents have removed U.S. attorneys in the past. It seemed to do it as a matter of course, almost, when they become president. So the question of whether or not these people should have been removed is really not the issue here. The issue is how they have handled the removal of them and how they have then really changed the story, changed the circumstances, retroactively gone back and looked at what happened. And then somebody was obviously embarrassed by some of the stuff that was said. They don't want to reveal the extent to which Karl Rove and the political shop at the White House was involved. It is just a process. And this, I think, is quite a familiar thing late in administrations of an administration which is essentially unraveling. As I say, where people are resigning, people are tired, people are very demoralized. Largely at the root of all this, of course, is the war in Iraq, which you've been talking about. But the sense of a near collapse, actually, in the administration, I think, is really quite profound. And I think this is really where this is going. And it's hard to see how it ends because, as I say, as you get late in an administration, the kind of the demoralization of those left in the administration simply grows. So this doesn't look like it's going to have a happy ending for anybody.
Gene Cummings, let me just come to you on this front for a minute. Gerard saying, well, it's about how it was handled. There seems some debate there, especially. Of course, there was the moment this week when Monica Goodling, who was the conduit between the Justice Department and the White House, her lawyer says she will take the Fifth rather than testify. Let's listen to Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy pushing back on that for a minute in his comments on Monica Goodling.
If she feels that what she has to tell us would subject her to criminal prosecution, well, that raises some really serious questions.
You take the Fifth, people wonder what's going on. Gene Cummings, is this really still all about process? Or when people look in at Karl Rove and the rest, the kind of micromanaging you were talking about, does it go somewhere beyond just process and maybe lies in the process?
Well, that's a big part of this, what's happening, is that they gave all of these shifting reasons for why these people were fired. They first said it was performance, and then they said it was voter fraud, and then they said it was immigration.
Voter fraud, that is, they did not pursue voter fraud charges as vigorously as Karl Rove would have liked. But you've written that was, in a way, part of a campaign strategy, perhaps as much as a legal strategy.
Oh, absolutely. The Republicans launched a major program during the 2004 presidential campaign to track down voter fraud, primarily aimed at people who they expected to be Democratic voters. And this was to combat an aggressive voter registration program on behalf of the Democrats.
Of course, voter registration is not voter fraud.
No, it's not. And even if you get the registration wrong, then that's not the same crime as casting an illegal vote. That's just making a mistake on your registration. So, but they were trying to lay out a record of voter fraud that they were then going to claim was instigated by this Democratic program. And what happened was there weren't that many complaints, and the U.S. attorneys, some of them tracked down, did investigations, and what they found, they couldn't really prosecute. And that was a big disappointment to the White House because the Republicans wanted a record that the Democratic program had led to these crimes, and they didn't get it. And that was that upset many of them. But what we have today is this is now about telling the truth. And that's a very different thing than why you fired them. And that's why Monica Goodling's taking the Fifth is so odd. She brought up Scooter Libby, that perhaps she's afraid if she misspoke or didn't remember something that she'd be subject to some sort of prosecution. And that may be what her concern is, but it's left a big cloud over the Justice Department that people are not telling the truth. And if they did tell the truth, that there would be some big repercussions. And this is, the Justice Department is under siege in so many other ways because of there have been recent stories about them micromanaging the tobacco lawsuit. And there have been long stories about them overruling career civil rights attorneys on the Voting Rights Act. And so this is just, the legal community is upset, and this is just, one thing after another, and it's going to be very hard for Gonzalez to dig his way out of this.
Jack Beattie, we're going to go to Iraq spending, to the British troops in Tehran, but how about this one, Justice Department and the crux of it? Where do you see the crux now? Where do you see a potential resolution, Jack?
Well, I don't know what the resolution is, but the crux is the integrity of Mr. Gonzalez, and there's plenty of evidence on the record to suggest he doesn't have any. When he was President Bush's counsel in Texas, he worked out a method on the clemency appeals that the death penalty convicts about to be executed would make. They would spend 20 minutes on each person. Bush wanted to get on to his exercising, and he wanted to run as governor of death. So they got it down to 20 minutes. And in case after case, Gonzalez did not tell Governor Bush about exonerating or exculpatory or other peculiar details that might have allowed these people, given the governor pause in his rush to kill these people. This has been documented by Alan Berlow, the former NPR reporter, in an eye-opening piece in the Atlantic Monthly, where just consistently Gonzalez, I guess picking up on signals from Bush, or perhaps just on his own, didn't tell the governor about things that might have saved someone's life. Things like, attorneys falling asleep defense attorneys falling asleep during trials.
Of course, the Senate moving this week after the House last week. Yes to funding, but with dates in there. Begin within months pulling out and further dates to follow. They've still got to talk that through with the House Republicans in high dudgeon about it. Here's John McCain speaking out against the war spending bill passed by the Senate, including a deadline suggested in the Senate's case to pull out troops.
This bill should be named the State Certain for Surrender Act. A second-year cadet at West Point will tell you if you announce to the enemy that you're leaving, it's a recipe for defeat. We are making progress in Iraq, and we're making significant progress. To hamstring and to announce that we are leaving is one of the most shameful things I've ever seen.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid responding here to President Bush's promise to veto the Democratic spending bill for Iraq.
I don't know if you could find in history any time that a president has done more to undermine the troops in the field than this. If the president vetoes this bill, it is an asterisk in history. He sets the record for undermining troops more than any president we've ever had.
All right, where's the crux of this one, Gene Cummings? We've been following this now for months and months and even years. At this point, split on funding. Funding runs out. The White House says April 15th. The Congress doesn't come back until April 16th. What is now the crux of this standoff as you see it?
Well, I think that the Democrats have two options here. They'll put together a bill in all likelihood with a date, and they'll send it to the president, and he'll veto it. And then they could stand firm and try again, or they could clean the bill up, send the funding over, and fight another day on the very same issue. Because there are other pieces of legislation where they could still continue to attach timetables to. And in the course of watching Nancy Pelosi, she's very calculating. And I wouldn't be surprised if she doesn't go with the option of making the Republicans vote over and over and over again to support the president and the war, and at the same time protect her own people by going ahead and letting the money go after she's made her point with the veto. They have that option, and politically that might be a very good option for them because they can't be accused of holding up the money for more than, a week? Mm-hmm. That's not going to matter. Mm-hmm. But they've got them on the record. They got Bush vetoing it. They've got the political argument.
Gerard Baker, Gene makes it sound as though the Democrats can both blink on this ultimately and win. Do you see it that way?
That's clearly what they think. I mean, it's very striking hearing from both Senator McCain and Senator Reid. It's what we're into here is not actually the substance of whether or not this war should continue or whether we should really have these benchmarks or whether there should be a date certain set for surrender, as John McCain calls it. It's really about how to avoid taking responsibility for what's going on. And the Democrats think, and they seem to have the situation on their side at the moment, that they can actually, by doing what they're doing, they can make sure that the responsibility, the Democrats to their very last senator and member of Congress think Iraq is a disaster. They think it's essentially lost. And they want to make sure that they certainly don't have it, cannot be given any blame whatsoever for the mess in Iraq, and that it should all be down to the president. The Republicans who are sort of somewhat split. Many of them are quite demoralized about Iraq and don't really think there's much of a positive outcome that's likely, want to try as far as possible to slough off their responsibility, the responsibility of the Bush administration, and to make the responsibility the Democrats. And so it's, you know, Washington, these politicians may or may not be very good at actually conducting a war, but they're really, really good at making sure that somebody else gets the blame. And I think that is what we are seeing here. The worry for Democrats, who otherwise hold all the cards, I mean, this is a minor worry for them, is that actually because they now control Congress, they could actually be held some way responsible. That actually in a year's time or so, if the U.S. is forced to withdraw from Iraq, if Iraq looks like a disaster as it does at the moment, then the Republicans will say, you know what, it wasn't ours. It wasn't a bad decision to invade Iraq. Maybe the president didn't put enough troops or whatever. But the real problem here, just as it was with Vietnam, was a Congress which did not have the stomach for the fight and did not
unwilling
have the
to go the
to
last yard.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm. That's clearly the Republican strategy. Quite frankly, I think it's John McCain's strategy, who is most obviously the presidential candidate who is most obviously identified with the war. If he can actually demonstrate that it is the Democrats who have been responsible, who are undermining the war, as he puts it, this date certain for surrender, then he has a hope, perhaps, of turning the war in some way to his advantage.
Jack, how do you see the policy and politics driving toward the crux here?
Well, they've described the politics. I just wish the Democrats would recognize they have public opinion with them, strong majorities, favor, date certain, and simply not give the president another bill and say, you want to do business with us, these are the terms, we'll perhaps work out on dates, but no more death of combat forces over there for nothing. And, you know, we got
But how would that play out, Jack? You're going to have troops with nothing, no MRIs, no bullets? I mean, how would that play out? If the funding really is let go, if they sort of shut down the war as Gingrich shut down the government a decade ago.
Well, the president would have to withdraw the troops. What really worries me, even when you look at these bills, the Senate bill would leave 50,000 troops there indefinitely, and their mission, training, counterterrorism, infrastructure protection, will be hazardous, and they will continue to die into the future. And you know, we got a picture last week of what's going on in Iraq, in Tal Afar, this city in the north, where we're torn apart by sectarian violence, nearly 150 people killed in 2 days. And here's what President Bush said last year about Tal Afar. He says, the example of Tal Afar gives me confidence in our strategy. Here's what a doctor at the Tal Afar hospital said yesterday. So many bloodied corpses were brought in on Tuesday night that the entry hall could not be kept clean. It would have looked inside the hospital as if we had painted the floor red. Bush went on and last year to talk about the mayor of Tal Afar and how this mayor was, he knew that we were making progress in Iraq. The mayor said the other day that if this keeps on happening, our city will be totally devastated. And the head of the National Command Center at the Interior Ministry in Iraq said, well, why was this happening in Tal Afar? Well, because the surge is quieting things in Baghdad, at least tempt some, because after all, 100 people killed yesterday, but it's forcing it out into the provinces. So essentially, we've just displaced the violence.
It is discouraging. Jack, I've got some tape from that of the president a year ago talking about Tal Afar, where at least 150 were pretty much slaughtered this week. Last year, the president was saying, here's a city that's a model for the rest of Iraq.
See, if you're a resident of Tal Afar today, this is what you're going to see. You see that the terrorist who once exercised brutal control over every aspect of your city has been killed or captured or driven out or put on the run. You see your children going to school and playing safely in the streets.
Safely in the streets, the president says a year ago. This week, blood all over those streets. Let's go to our listeners from Glastonbury, Connecticut. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to have your guest comment on the fact that Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah has said that the United States should get out of Iraq. And this is a huge change from what Prince Bandar said when the United States went into Iraq. So I'd like to hear what their comments are on losing our last Arab ally in the Middle East.
Let us pick it up. The Saudi king saying this week that it was illegal for the U.S. to be in neighboring Iraq. Gerard Baker, what do you make of that?
Well, the Saudis are playing a very complex game at the moment. They obviously, the Saudis have been, Saudis, remember there's a religious sectarian issue here.
Of course, Saudis Sunni, been, Saudis, Shia.
The Sunni minority in Iraq have been the ones who have been principally driving, obviously, the insurgency because they fear the Shia takeover of Iraq, which Shia is in the majority. And Saudi Arabia is a Sunni state. Saudi Arabia has, without any question, is almost not denying it anymore, has been providing support, financial and in some respects military support, to the Sunni insurgents in Iraq. And at the same time, the Bush administration has obviously been trying to get them to stop that, but also to get Saudi Arabia, once again, there's a very complex chess game going on here involving Iran, of course, which is another Shia state, Sunni, and with long history of enmity and of hostility with Saudi Arabia. So the U.S. has been trying to persuade the Saudis both to drop their support for the Sunni insurgents in Iraq and to take part in a broader regional operation to try and contain Shia power. And so far, the Saudis have actually been playing ball on that, as your caller said. Prince Bandar, the former ambassador here to Washington, has actually been pushing Saudi Arabia in that direction. So this took place, this announcement by the king at the Arab summit in Riyadh that's been taking place this week. You have to assume that there is an element of domestic politics here, both in terms of Saudi Arabia and in terms of Saudi Arabia's role in the Arab world, and particularly, as I say, hosting something as important as the Arab summit there. You have to assume that that is a degree of political positioning by the king, and they are worried, obviously, about the general what the problems in Iraq are doing, what the mess in Iraq is doing to the Saudi world in particular. So I don't think it should be just taken at face value what he said. It should be seen as part of a broad this very complex chess game that the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Israel, the Iraqi government are trying to play in terms of quelling the insurgency in Iraq, producing some kind of Middle East peace settlement between Israel and Palestine, and most important of all for all of these countries, containing the rise of Iran and preventing Iran from becoming the dominant regional power.
Maybe not at face value, but it's hardly shoulder to shoulder in public either. Let's look at another piece of that triangle you describe, Iran, very much in the news with your country this week. Here just today is British serviceman Nathan Thomas Summers appearing in a video aired on Arab television.
Since we've been arrested in Iran, our treatment has been very friendly. We have not been harmed at all. They've looked after us really well. Basically, the food they've been serving us has been good. And I'm grateful for no harm has come to us. I'd like to apologise for entering your waters without any permission. I know it happened back in 2004, and our government promised that it wouldn't happen again.
Gerard Baker, headlines of rage in London. 15 British Marines and naval personnel picked up in the waters there, now in Tehran. This is a familiar kind of dynamic to American eyes going all the way back to 1979. The British say their forces were 1.7 nautical miles inside Iraqi territorial waters. Iran says 0.3 miles inside Iranian. What is going on here, Gerard Baker, and how does this one end?
Well, this is pretty despicable behavior, obviously, by the Iranians, and it's clear by a group of Iranians, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, who are, if you like, the most radical, most extremist section in Iran. The claim by the Iranians that these troops, these sailors, were actually inside Iranian waters is completely bogus and was well demonstrated as such by the British government this week when it said, it pointed out that the initial, the Iranians themselves, the Iranian officials themselves gave coordinates, positioning coordinates for the for where the incident took place. They gave those coordinates, and when the British looked at those coordinates, it was indeed where the British thought it was, which was inside Iraqi waters, which of course the British are permitted to patrol and permitted to stop boats there inside Iraqi waters under a UN mandate. So the British said, well, what's the problem here? These are indeed in Iraqi waters. That's exactly where we said they were. And then obviously somebody in the Iranian foreign ministry or wherever else said, oh my God, we made a bit of a mistake here. So they went back about a day later, came back with new coordinates, which supposedly put this incident inside Iranian waters.
But now they're sitting in Tehran. What happens here? Britain looks helpless at the moment.
Well, it does at the moment. I don't know whether it's, you know, I don't know whether it clearly it is. I mean, there are limited military options here in terms of what Britain can do. These sailors have been taken. They probably are in Tehran, though there are some hotheads saying Britain should start bombing or just threaten to start bombing. I don't believe that helps at all. I think actually, you know, it's an interesting thing. Sometimes when countries engage in what are intended to be displays of force, they actually demonstrate something quite the opposite. In fact, they're often displays really of weakness. And I wonder if that isn't what's going on here. There is something very interesting going on inside Iran at the moment, involving the Revolutionary Guard, involving, I think, the weakening of extremist elements close to President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who is, of course, to whom the Revolutionary Guard reports. They have seen in the last few weeks, they've seen Iran sanctions at the UN against Iran. They've seen, as I say, a more concerted effort, as we were talking about earlier, a more concerted effort by some of the countries in the region to try and contain Iran. And we've it's not entirely clear to me that things are going Iran's way. So it's actually a playing this out by Britain, not overreacting, not in any way threatening military action, building steadily a process of diplomatic and ultimately economic sanctions, and then in the end, you know, if we, as this further goes on, then becoming more and more threatening. This is the right approach for Britain to take. It may be frustrating, and it may look like Britain's being humiliated and weakened in the eyes of the world and in the eyes of the Iranians, but actually this, I think, is most people see this for what it is, which is an outrage against
the right, and maybe the only right now. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Bill is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Bill, you're on the air.
Thanks. I originally had this question with regard to the Justice Department scandal, but it seems to relate to the debate on Iraq as well, in that in spite of maybe the objective facts that the Democrats have on their side concerning the scandals and concerning the war, I'm not sure that's the way it's playing in the heartland. And there's a recent David Broder column in which the Democrats, while with much higher approval ratings than the Republicans, were only 4 points higher than they were in 1994. And we all know what happened then. I'm just wondering if your panelists can comment on whether the Democrats are perceived as overreaching and perhaps not following what the voters really wanted them to do, which is to reach across the aisle and find some consensus, bipartisan consensus on Iraq, and maybe get some of the 9/11, the Iraq Study Group recommendations implemented, or get some kind of a groundswell of support that wouldn't seem like Washington infighting.
Yeah, let us pick it up. Gene Cummings, how do you assess that risk for the Democrats? Now, they're driving the boat on a lot of fronts here. Big confrontations in its wake. Do they risk outrunning popular opinion, or do you see them maneuvering adroitly?
Well, the caller's right. That is the great risk to them, is that they will overreach and they'll fall back into the patterns of the Republicans before them, where partisan issues rule and loyalty rules. They have some time, I think, to level out their scorecard. And the Democratic leadership in Congress claim that they will, but they have to do it. I think that the voters, they are upset with the war, and that was the number one issue, and so it has become the number one priority for the new Congress. But they have other things that they want to do as well, and they do eventually need to move to those things. I mean, ultimately, their goal would be to run for re-election with a reining in spending, showing some discipline on the budget, and also passing some domestic initiatives. The minimum wage is likely to be passed. The president said he'll sign that. They want to work together on immigration reform, the White House and the Democrats. So they do need a more balanced agenda when they go out there. And in terms of the war, while the public support broadly, nationally, is with them, really for the House, they look at the country more as a quilt. And each of those squares is a congressional district. And the public opinion inside some of those really important districts might be different than the national poll. And that's why the Democrats have to tread more carefully here. That caller, for instance, may not be among those who says, set a date and let's get out of here tomorrow. But a caller from California might well think that. So it's a very complex set of politics that they're working with up there. And I think the caller's right, that they do have to tread carefully.
Let's hear another caller on exactly this issue, John from Cambridge, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I guess in the back of my head, the very simple point that we do have a date certain that's specified, and I don't think that people are blind to it, but it's not an IQ test.
A date for what, John? A date for withdrawal from Iraq?
Yes. It's November 4th. 2008, when the elections occur. No Republican that wants to stay in office is going to weigh in against that. So let the public be heard. but there is a date.
And but John McCain is saying we've got to go the distance, and that's a very important date for someone like him. He's not saying out by November 4th, 08.
Yeah, fine. Well, all that point of view will be pretty significantly marginalized on the election.
So there's another view, Jack.
I think he's actually raising a really good point, mm-hmm. and that is there are plenty of Republicans up on Capitol Hill that do not want to go into their next reelection mm-hmm. carrying the war on their back. And so what we may see is over the course of time an erosion in the Republican support and for staying with the Bush policy on Iraq, and that we already are seeing it, and it then may grow, and that we saw two Republicans vote for the resolution this week that set a date. If the
Gordon
Democrats
Smith and
bring
Chuck
it
Hagel,
back,
yep.
right, if the Democrats bring it back again in 3 months, might there be five? You know, this thing could shift and evolve over the course of time, in part because the Republicans do not want the war to continue.
Jack, what do you say?
Yeah, and you know, you see with John McCain this week he's really taken a flight from reality on this. He was saying to the Democrats, you're not up with the current facts which show progress in Iraq. On a radio interview, he said General Petraeus goes out there with an unarmored Humvee every day. He says you can walk through neighborhoods now in Baghdad and feel perfectly safe. And he went on in this vein. And, Michael Ware of Time Magazine said, what is he talking about? This week, for the first time, the Greens, people in the Green Zone walking from building to building, that is government employees, American soldiers, are going to have to wear flak jackets because it's too dangerous. Of course, Petraeus is armored all the time. And today's New York Times points out on the front page a poignant story of how the ethnic cleansing is going on in these neighborhoods. Sunni woman murdered because she tried to defend tried to stay in her own home. And of course, one of the government ministers in charge of finding homes for people and dealing with the breach is who else? Ahmed Chalabi.
Let's take a call from Chalet in Concord, Massachusetts. Chalet, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I had 2 points regarding the British sailors kept in Iran.
Yes.
The first, there was no war between Britain and Iran at the time, so there is no violation of Geneva Convention, as these prisoners, they weren't prisoners of war. They were, as far as Iran is concerned, they were just illegally, a crew who illegally entered Iranian waters. Second, is that Iran shows the videos of this. Hello?
Yes, we're here.
Oh, yeah. Iran shows the videos of these captors basically through the Arabic-speaking Al-Alam TV.
Right.
Therefore, the audience is basically the Arab people and the local native people of the Middle East.
What difference does that make, Shana?
Yeah, because they are very tired of people illegally invading their countries, occupying them, obviously breaking the Geneva Convention.
Let me ask you, are you from Iran? And what do you make of Gerard Baker's perspective that this is kind of a last stand by hardliners or an attempt by hardliners to rally support in Iran? Do you see it that way?
No, I don't, because what I'm seeing is that Iranians are getting really tired of international pressure for what is basically their right. They consider that the Brits have entered their water illegally.
Gerard Baker, what do you say to Chalet there?
Well, it's not. Again, as I said earlier, it was pretty clear from the evidence that was presented by the Iranians that either they're not very good at map reading, or that they are very good at map reading, and actually, someone sent the wrong coordinates out. It was pretty clear that the British were not operating in Iranian waters, and it's
of course that is not what the Iranians are saying, and in fact, they're insisting on an acknowledgement and apology that they were in Iranian waters before they can go.
Yeah, the Iranians also say, of course, they're not developing a nuclear weapon. They also say that they are a free country who allow their people to express themselves completely freely. They also say that the Holocaust never happened. So I think we need to be a little bit careful about taking the Iranians at their word.
Could we get into a kind of redux of the 1979 American hostage crisis in Tehran? Do you think it will go that far, Gerard?
Well, I don't think it'll go 444 days, if that's what you mean. I don't know. I think it's clearly Britain, and it, you know, another point just to raise about your Jack and your caller earlier, who seems to think this is all a British plot or a Bush-Blair plot. I mean, it is a slightly odd way for Britain to be responding in such a calm and measured way if this is all a deliberate provocation of the Iranians. But nonetheless, we'll see how it goes. I mean, maybe this is all part of the dastardly plot that actually Britain will steadily build up and will be bombing Tehran in a few days. I kind of doubt it, quite frankly.
We hear that.
I don't think there's any desire for Britain to do that, and I don't think this is a provocation. But who knows? I mean, this could clearly, you know, there were from people I spoke to in London in the first few days of this crisis a week ago, there was hope that this would be exactly what it was a few years ago when the Iranians seized some British sailors and then returned them after sort of parading them around for a few days and gave them back just after 3 days. And there was hope that this would be the same this time. This looks more serious, more prolonged, and it probably is related to what's going on at the United Nations with the Iranian, with the sanctions on Iran. Mm. We'll have to just see to what extent Britain is able to mobilise the international community. Already we've got a UN resolution. It will meet with European Union ministers this weekend to try and get some kind of economic sanctions against Iran, and we'll have to see how far the Iranians really want to push it. That's, I think, in the end, what it comes down to. I don't think Britain intends military action. I don't think it intends escalating this into an all-out confrontation. But it's up to the Iranians, really. I think the ball is in the Iranians' court as to actually how far they want to push it.
But watch out. There's a lot of history here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me go to Joy in Tupper Lake, New York. Hi, Joy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to draw a couple of parallels to Vietnam. First of all, in 1964, the American public basically voted against the war in Vietnam by electing Lyndon Johnson. And that was subverted by, of course, the Gulf of Tonkin lie, which was admitted 25 years later. And in 2006, the American public voted against the war in Iraq, basically. And the second parallel is very odd, I find, that the American military in Vietnam, one of the reasons why they lost was they would go from town to town, secure a town, leave it, and then the Kong would come in and take it over. And they're doing this in Iraq. They're going into a town, securing it, leaving, and then all hell breaks loose when they're gone.
So what do you take from it all, Joy? Vietnam went on a long time after LBJ was elected.
Yes, it did. It went on a long time because people in Washington got involved in politics instead of reality.
Many interpretations of where that line lies here. Joy, thanks for your call. Let me get another from David in Milford, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is admittedly a military question, but the other day John McCain said, well, any cadet at West Point knows you don't tell the enemy when what your plans are when you're departing. So my question would be, why would insurgents or al-Qaeda bother harassing and engaging our departing troops, say, a year from now as we departed, number one, and number two, as opposed to lying low and waiting for us to go and then engaging the Shiites. And number two, would this, once we announce this, this, of course, does put pressure on the Maliki government to prepare and either combat the insurgents or not. I don't see the military problem with our departing. People take that for granted in announcing our departure, and I'd be interested in the comments on that.
David, thanks for that. Gene Cummings, what about a date? Let's say the Democrats don't just politic it. Let's say that they somehow pull out a date here. Militarily, how does that translate?
Well, I'm not a military expert, and it does seem as though there are a variety of scenarios that could play out. And I think that the concern is if you do set a date and they just lay low, and you pull your troops out, and all hell breaks loose, and Iraq falls into a civil war that then explodes further into to encompass the region, because, let's say Saudi Arabia goes in to help the Sunni minority.
And all this potentially before November 08.
Well, I think that when McCain and others think about it, is that if we do something that results in the Middle East region, having this titanic battle, then that is our failure, and that is a much bigger failure, they view it, than staying and trying to stabilize Iraq to make sure that there is not that sort of expansion of the conflict. Will it happen? I have no idea. And again, I'm not any kind of military expert. Clearly, those who want to set the date believe that if that is to come then, you know, our troops who are there are probably never going to prevent it. If that's where the region is going to go, then it's going to go on its own.
Jack Beatty, political perils then on both sides of that date question.
Yes, but you know, McCain is putting it in military terms. As the Iraq Study Group pointed out, this is a political issue. The issue is, will this Shiite government make the accommodations to the other communities it has to make on the Constitution and other things in order to tamp down this insurgency? And the threat of removing our troops is the only lever we have to force this government into that kind of political accommodation. And if Bush had his wits, he could use these Democratic resolutions as a club to say, look what these people want to do. You guys have got to show us progress now. That's the only way we're going to get out of there. It has nothing to do with the military.
Gerard Baker?
Bush is already doing that.
Obviously, Jack's right. From his point of view, he's right. From McCain's point of view, and I think probably from General Petraeus' point of view as well, as he continues to say, it depends whether or not you believe there is a military, whether there is something to be gained militarily by staying in Iraq for the next, and indeed by increasing forces as the U.S. is doing over the next 6 months. And that's the point. If you can actually crush the insurgency, which McCain believes you can and Petraeus perhaps believes you can, over the next 6 months, then of course it's worth doing. If you don't think that's possible at all, if it's only a political solution that can work, then your caller's right. What's the point? I mean, just get out now or announce you're getting out whenever you like.
We'll talk more about exactly that. Gerard, we've got to bug out here. We'll talk more about exactly that with Tom Ricks on Monday. Gerard Baker with the London Times, Gene Cummings with thePolitico.com, and Jack Beatty, great to have you all with us this hour. Thank you so much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.